Well, hello there, and welcome to Agree or Disagree, the podcast. This is Kevin Olenek. Thank you very much for listening. We are still in the aftermath of, quite frankly, something pretty earth-shattering. I don't know what the word is. Earth-shattering is a good word, I think.
I think so. I mean, if we think about the magnitude of what happened, I mean, it's the first time in 45 years that we've seen change like this in this province. And I think a lot of people here in Calgary especially keep waking up every morning expecting to see buildings on fire or downtown leveled to the ground because we have an NDP majority. And, you know, we're 5 days after the election now, and none of that's happened yet.
No. So. The voice you're hearing there is Jordan Pinkster. Jordan is the president of the Calgary Southeast
PC Association.
He was helping Rick Fraser get his seat. And we are going to spend some time talking about what the heck happened to the PC party. How did this happen? We'll get his kind of his perspective. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
I guess let's start. I guess we have to start at the top. And Jim Prentice. And he, there's a lots that happened, I guess, but a lot of it has to be on his shoulders. A lot of people will give that to him. What kind of give us your perspective of
that? I think you're. I mean, anytime that you're in a leadership position, you're going to take the credit or the blame for something like this happening. I mean, as much as Rachel Notley is accepting a lot of the credit for how well the NDP did in this election, Jim Prentice is equally accepting the responsibility for how bad this all really ended up. You know, I remember hearing conversations in the aftermath of the Alison Redford situation of what the party's prospects were from a leadership position. And generally the consensus within the party was that Jim Prentice was the only person that could save the situation. That if we didn't find some way to convince Jim Prentice to run for leader, the party was doomed. You know, not that the party is doomed today. I mean, the party is still alive and well. But, you know, again, we fast forward, you know, almost a year. And even with Jim Prentice, we weren't able to save ourselves in this last election. So it's really interesting to see. Again, I think that Jim got labeled with that CEO premier tag quite often through the campaign. I think a big part of being premier is not only being the right man for the job, but being electable as well. And I think that Jim struggled with that ability to connect with voters to a degree. You know, I have no doubt in my mind that Jim Prentice would have made a fantastic premier had he been given a mandate and the opportunity to start implementing the vision that he had for how to make Alberta better. But unfortunately, if you don't get voted, you don't get an opportunity to do things like that. You know, if you look at kind of the political opportunism that he took advantage of here to try to call an early election when his opponents were scattered and leaderless to a degree, again, you know, he played the political game about as well as you could to set himself up for success in this election. And it ended up in resounding failure. Again, I think that messaging from the beginning was a big struggle for the PCs throughout the campaign. You know, we can harken back to the Jim Prentice look in the mirror comment.
Right.
I think a lot of us that, you know, we understood what he was trying to say. He was trying to tell people that, again, you know, this is difficult times for all Albertans, and if we're going to get out of this, we have to do it together. This is going to be a team effort moving forward. And I think that's a completely appropriate message to go with. But I think to say, look in the mirror, that's rubbing the average Albertan's face in it, I think. And it's kind of patronizing as well. And I think that ticked off so many Albertans that you were fighting an uphill battle from there. And then, you know, go to the televised debate where, you know, hashtag math is hard.
Math is hard.
You know, again, I get that you're being cheeky. I get that you're taking advantage of an opportunity in a debate to say something that you thought might have been clever or whatever. It came across as patronizing. It came across as disrespectful. And that, if the by-elections in October last year taught us anything, it's that Albertans are gravitating towards these ideas of hope and positivity as opposed to that negative, slinging mud end of things.
Right. So. There was a lot of people that felt that this goes back to 08, to Stelmach, and 12 to Redford, that the party was doomed from that point on. Would you agree with that, or what are your thoughts on that?
I think we've seen a growing divide within the party since then. Again, I haven't been involved with the party for that terribly long. I've only held a PC membership for about 4 years. I started helping Rick Fraser in the 2012 campaign, and that was my first exposure to the party, really. But from people that I've talked to, again, this level of unanimous approval of the leader didn't exist after Ralph Klein. You know, the leaderships that were held after that, until Prentice, of course, were quite divisive. You had opposing camps. Neither of them liked each other. When one of them won, the defeated group didn't want to play nice after the fact. You know, it got very heated. And it left some folks with really hard feelings. I mean, you saw in the Redford leadership that she becomes leader, and then Gary Marr gets exiled off to Hong Kong for a number of years, just because, again, politically you couldn't have him close by. So, you know, again, I think we lost sight of what made us successful for so long, and that was, you know, providing a reason to be involved to our members. And that's the biggest thing that I've struggled with at the local level for sure is, you know, when I'm talking to people about getting their PC membership and being a part of the process, is they ask, well, why should I do that? And I don't exactly have an answer for them. In fact, I don't really have an answer for myself either. You know, why am I involved? What's in it? What's the benefit? What's the value add for being a part of the process? And, you know, again, if we can't find a way to motivate our volunteers and our members to be active and be a part of the process, you know, that's not a good situation to be in. The PCs have prided themselves for so long in being a grassroots party. And what that means is that policies and ideas are developed at the grassroots, at the constituency level. That feedback is brought up through the party to those senior people in the party that make the decision. And, you know, the government finds a way to legislate that. And we've gotten away from that. There was an AGM for the PCs, I think it was about 2 years ago now, where a resolution passed on the floor of the AGM to get rid of daylight savings time. It was a brilliantly crafted policy. It was something that could have been legislated for sure. It passed almost unanimously on the floor of the AGM. Yet, you know, there was a few cabinet ministers at the time that had some, you know, I thought, kind of patronizing comments at the end of it all, saying, "Oh, you know, that's kind of cute that you went and made this policy, and it's, you know, that's great, but we're never actually going to legislate something like that." And I think that rubs members the wrong way. I think again, we're looking for our voice to be heard in the party system. You know, your candidates or your MLAs in some cases are supposed to be reflective of the views of the membership. And if they're not reflective of the views of the membership, then whose views are they reflective of? And right. I think it's a question that a lot of people are asking themselves today.
You showed me your card, and a card had, your membership card had Jim Prentice on it. Was it too much Prentice, not enough PC?
I think so. I think that we need to get back to recognizing that no one individual is bigger than the party. You know, my PC membership card has Team Prentice or Jim Prentice on the back of it. If you saw all of the signs throughout the entire campaign, they all said vote the Prentice team. When I was at campaign college about 2 weeks before the writ was dropped, we weren't really fed information about what the message was or what the policy was or what ideas we were selling this campaign. It was basically a brand that we were trying to promote, and the brand was Jim Prentice. We were told at campaign college that the Premier's brand is really strong right now, so you need to do everything that you can to, you know, promote the Premier's brand. Run with that and you will be successful. And if you looked at a lot of the campaign literature that the PCs had, it had your candidate shaking hands with Jim Prentice. It was, you know, they put their eggs in one basket, essentially. And I think if you've got a popular leader that resonates with a lot of people, you can really use that as a political asset. But if something goes off the rails and the Premier says something that, you know, can cost you an election, or, you know, he starts to really not resonate well with voters, your candidate's going down with him. And when you tie someone that closely to yourself, it can cause some problems. So I do look forward to the party having some discussions about, again, how we can get back to that, being identified as more than just our leader. Because parties are about more than just a leader. It's about the members. It's about the process. It's about everything else.
If this was Lukasik or McIver, are we in the same boat or are we in a different boat?
I don't know. That's really hard to say. I mean, hindsight's 20/20 in these kinds of things. I mean, I look at Rick McIver, and Rick McIver resonates with your average Albertan. I mean, I grew up in Calgary Hayes.
Right.
He was my alderman for 8 years, and you know, and then MLA for a number of years as well. And anybody that's met Rick McIver says, "That's my friend Rick." He kind of had that Ralph Klein element right there. So I think I look at an electability aspect, and Rick had that ability to really connect with people on an individual basis. I also look at the budget. I'm not convinced that, you know, with Rick McIver as leader, that budget would have looked the way that it did. You know, it was not the most fiscally conservative budget in the entire world. We saw tax increases, 59 new taxes.
Right.
There was a lot in that that made quite a few of the good hard right conservatives really kind of scratch their head and say, what exactly are we doing with this budget? I really can't speak to what Thomas Lukaszczyk could have brought to the table as leader. I don't know a lot about Thomas. I mean, he's all the way up in Edmonton. That seems like a world away for me. and, you know, the one thing that I do know about Thomas, again, is that he has that ability to get on the doors and resonate and represent his constituents really well, which is why I was personally shocked that Thomas lost by 7,000 votes in his riding. Because if you want to talk to somebody that's a good constituent in L.A., you know, he was there for his people. He helped a lot of people in that constituency for a number of years. I was shocked to see that margin of defeat for Thomas Lukaszczyk up in Edmonton, for sure.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a little bit. The one other thing that I do want to touch on, I think, before we go to the floor crossers, is Gordon Dirks. I mentioned that I think he had to take a hit for this because Bill 10, he said nothing one way or the other. We did a podcast with some people that were actually concerned about Bill 10, and they were upset that he didn't say anything. The other side of that, people were very much upset, and he didn't say anything. Then all of a sudden, a message comes out not 2 weeks before the campaign. I helped with Bill 10. What happened? I guess that's the best.
I don't know what happened. I mean, I think any time that you bring in an elected minister to take care of a particular portfolio, you set the bar really high. You're putting a high expectation on that individual that this is the person that is best fit to handle this portfolio. And I have a sneaking suspicion that when Gordon Dirks took the time, he was not anticipating that Bill 10 was going to come down the pipe.
Right.
That was not one of the priorities that Gordon Dirks was going to be tasked with as education minister.
Right.
I look at what the priority was, essentially, was building schools. It was infrastructure was the main focus. I mean, you look at the infrastructure minister was tasked with the same thing. It's the two of you get in a room together and figure out how many schools you have to make. So when I think when the Bill 10 thing kind of came out of left field on them, I think they were so unprepared to deal with it. And if you look at, you know, Mr. Dirks' personal beliefs and some of his personal history, you know, a lot of us could reasonably look at it and say there's no way personally that he would ever support a bill like that.
Yeah.
There's simply no way. So I think it was a big misstep. And I think the communications were handled very poorly. And then I look at what happened during the campaign where at one point he actually tried to take credit for GSAs.
Yeah.
You know, again, that might work on someone that was living under a rock for the previous 3 months or had no idea what was going on. But for the vast majority of people that were paying attention, that was a very odd thing for you to take credit for. Same thing with the Gordon Dirks is rebuilding this school.
Right.
That was a decision that was made 4 months before he was put into cabinet. You know, he can't take credit for something that he didn't do, essentially. You know, the Alberta Party is terrific from a social media perspective. I've had my own commentary that I think that they need to do more on the ground.
Yes.
They need to do, you know, pounding doors. They need to get into the communities and do more of a grassroots thing, talking to people. That's my personal opinion. But from a social media standpoint, they're fantastic. They're on top of it. You can't have something happen like Gordon Dirks taking credit for GSAs without it blowing up and everybody finding out over social media.
Right.
And I think that Calgary Elba was a very compelling race in this election. It was a race that I think Albertans as a whole were watching very, very closely. I think in a more bland riding, that a race that maybe wasn't nearly as contentious or just it wasn't as important, you probably could have gotten away with some messaging like that. But the fact that everyone was paying attention and you tried to send something like that down the pipe, that's tough. That's a really tough thing to do.
Did you see it kind of like permeating in other campaigns though? It could come across like there's this arrogant PC, entitled PC.
I think so. I think that resonates from the lack of a message the PCs had through the entire campaign. I've kind of talked at length about this on social media over the course of the last little while, that whenever the polls came in, whenever, you know, there was a question on whether the PCs would survive this election, everyone kept on pointing back to the PCs' ability to get the vote out.
Right.
It's this amazing GOTV machine that you've got to tack an extra 5 to 10 percentage points onto every poll because the PCs get their supporters out to the polls better than any other party in the province. And I still to this day believe that that's true. I was scrutineering at a polling station on election day for 7 hours. I was the only scrutineer for any party that was there. I talked to a number of other supporters as well. They said the same thing. I was the only scrutineer there in terms of making the phone calls, the work that goes into election day. I think the PCs do it better than anybody. But that was the message that they tried to sell was, well, doesn't matter how much support we have, we're going to get more of that out to the polling stations than the other parties. The fact of the matter is very simple, is there isn't a vote to get out if there's no votes to get. And I think that was the big downfall, is we didn't give people a reason. You know, we were hitting the doors on a regular basis, and they said, yeah, you know, I like you, you're a good MLA, you're a good guy, but I just can't vote for your party because I haven't been given a reason to. And I think that was the overriding message kind of across the province for a lot of people, is people had warned the PCs for two campaigns now and said, I'm giving you one more chance.
Right.
If you screw it up, you're done. And we called their bluff to a degree in 2012 and got away with it. I think they tried to do it again this year, and we're punished very severely for it.
The floor crossing, the 7, the 9, whatever, Danielle Smith, It was looked upon at the time as ruthless, but a brilliant move by Prentice. How did this all play out?
I think for me personally, I'm still not over it, to be perfectly honest with you. I think for me, I looked at the floor crossings and I looked and said, again, we're supposed to be just one happy conservative family now. I mean, these are people that went out of their way to make our lives miserable for the last 4 or 5 years from a PC perspective. You know, some of the mud that was slung across, some really personal stuff to a degree that the opposition hurled at some of our MLAs over the course of the last while. And then to just kick the doors in and say, hey, come on in, you know, all's forgiven, come on, you know, welcome aboard. That didn't sit well with me personally.
Right.
My personal opinion is that if there were Wild Rose MLAs that were considering floor crossing, that they were dead in the water going into the next campaign anyways. If you've got that level of dissension within the party's ranks, they're going down big time. So the fact that they were thrown a political lifeline, so to speak, and given new life as new PC MLAs was really difficult for me. And I was quite vocal, actually. I said I didn't get all the information up front. I heard about floor crossings. I heard various rumors in terms of safe nominations or promises of cabinet postings, all that kind of stuff. And for me, I looked at it and said, well, if there's promises of cabinet postings and safe nominations, I'm out. I can't keep doing this because we've got a system in place. And if we just secure nominations for floor crossers, that's not the way the system is supposed
right.
to work. So I was very encouraged to see that these folks did have to go through nominations. Many of them lost their nominations, as you now know, and no cabinet postings were promised. And I think the message that would have sent to the rest of the PC caucus would have been very poor. I mean, we already saw a pretty aggressive message sent to that PC caucus when Stephen Mandel and Gordon Dirks were named into cabinet. The message was pretty clear. The premier was not satisfied with the level of talent within his caucus, so he had to bring some outsiders in order to fill some gaps, essentially. So,
What were your thoughts on Daniel Smith's behavior through this election?
I thought it was really interesting. I mean, I think the one thing to keep into perspective is that through the entire process, Daniel Smith was still an MLA.
That's true.
Up until when the Rittvers dropped, and
yeah.
she had a lot of things to say leading
yeah.
up to the campaign. You know, you're looking at some of the recent things that she's been talking about, how she kind of feels like she was duped by Jim Prentice, and that budget was never something that she was going to be able to support, and I see it totally.
Right.
I look at the likes of Danielle Smith and Rob Anderson, and I think a budget that has 59 new taxes, how are those two ever going to support that budget?
Right.
I'm not sure what next step is for Danielle Smith. I mean, I think she's posturing herself for whatever the next career is going to be. It isn't in politics, obviously. I found her insight fascinating because I think that Danielle Smith had a perspective on this election that nobody else in the province could have possibly had. You know, she was on the inside. She understood both sides of the dynamic here. One of the most fascinating quotes that she had that came out was that she kind of urged Jim Prentice not to become leader of the PC party, just because, again, she thought it was kind of futile, or that it was going to end poorly for him. So that was really interesting. And again, she made one really impressive point to me, was with the split in the vote. A lot of the conservative votes that went Wild Rose, that cut that PC vote in half, you know, she said, again, if you had united the right, we wouldn't be in the situation that we are today. It would not have been a PC or an NDP majority if it would have been a true merger that had happened when those floor crossings happened. I think in most cases, in a lot of ridings, you saw, I think the NDP candidates took 40% of the vote
yeah.
or something along those lines, and you had a PC candidate that won 25, a Wild Rose candidate that won 20 to 25 as well. And if you combine the two, I mean, a lot of these NDP candidates would have lost.
Do you think we need to unite the right? Quote unquote.
I don't know. I think I look at the Wild Rose Party and I do tip my cap to them. You know, again, they were put in a situation that would have been very easy to lose coming up into this campaign. A brand new leader, a party that was in disarray with the floor crossings, and they were able to find a way to develop a very simple campaign message that resonated with a lot of people and sell it. And I still question their ability to resonate in urban Alberta. I mean, they don't have a seat in an urban riding in the province. But the fact that under Brian Jean's leadership, they were able to stabilize to a degree and get things going in the right direction was very impressive. Now, again, I think that inability to resonate with urban Albertans is a reason why I think a merger would be very, very difficult, because I think the messaging between the PCs and Wild Rose is still a ways apart. Now, we have to see which direction the PCs go in after this campaign, and when they start to figure out, how do we fix this? Do we shift further to the right? Do we shift further to the left? Where does the PC party need to be in order to be successful in this campaign? And that will dictate essentially what happens. I can't remember who it was. I think it was Brian Jean already that said that he would not entertain any conversations about a merger. And of course he's going to say that right now. But again, we'll see what happens.
If you were the top of the PC food chain, is it too early to ask this question? But what's the first thing that you need to do?
Yikes. I think a lot of the senior PC people need to go through a state of mourning first. And I think that's totally understandable at this stage. I mean, this is the biggest kick in the teeth that we've ever experienced as a party. So I think that state of mourning needs to happen. We need to take some time to reflect and identify where things went wrong. I know there's people within the PC party that want to see somebody's head on a pike at this stage. Somebody has to pay for this colossal failure. I don't know who that is. I have no answers for that. So we'll see what happens. Again, I know that senior members of the PC party have reached out to membership and said, again, we're going to take some time to digest what just happened, but we're going to start having those conversations very quickly in terms of what the next steps are. I personally hope that the direction that's set on how we right the ship is a collaborative one. I don't want something that's taken from the top and shoved down membership's throat in terms of this is the direction we need to go. I hope that we can sit down and have some long and detailed conversations in terms of what members' will is to take the next steps for the PC party.
I tossed the name of Rick Fraser as a leader, potential leader. You might have some thoughts on that.
I think it's too early to tell. I think, again, we've got... I can't remember after they finished these recounts and some of the ones that are contested. We've got 9 or 10 PC MLAs at this stage. And I think that all of them are probably evaluating what they, as a leader, would look like in this particular situation. I think Rick McIver is very well situated to step in as leader of the PC party at this stage. I mean, again, he's former cabinet minister under the last government, finished second in the leadership last time around. I think a lot of people are kind of getting themselves prepared for Rick McIver's leadership of the PC party moving forward here. We'll see what happens in the next couple of weeks here. Again, I think a lot of these questions are going to be asked. I think essentially every one of those MLAs that survived this last election could potentially be a candidate to be the next leader of the party. But they're going to have to sit down and have those conversations with their families and with their boards and identify, again, is this something that I should go for? We have to keep in mind the level of volunteer fatigue that exists within the PC party right now. If you look at what's happened over the course of the last year, we went through everything that happened with Alison Redford, which was emotionally draining for everybody in the party. We went through a leadership contest. We went through a series of by-elections. We went through a general election. And now we're gearing up for another by-election and then another leadership as well. So volunteers are tapped out. I mean we've asked a lot of our volunteers over the course of the last year. I look at it to a degree and say, you know what, if we had one candidate that put his name forward for the PC leadership, I'm not sure that would be a bad thing at this stage because, again, I'm not sure we can draw anything more out of our volunteers right now for another, you know, again, potentially lengthy leadership race.
Right. So you went door knocking, and one of the things that was sort of the part of the aftermath, so we'll talk about the aftermath, are you one that is, I guess let's start here in terms of big picture. There has been some fright out there with the new Alberta Stand leaders, quote unquote. are you concerned?
I think it's a classic saying in Alberta politics that we don't vote governments in, we vote governments out.
Right.
And what I heard on the doors reflects what happened in this last election. It didn't matter who the candidate was, they wanted to see the PCs out. I mean, you saw various movements on social media of here is your anybody but PC candidate to vote in all of these ridings. There was a number of bloggers that had quite a bit of information on who to vote for to get these PCs out of here type thing. And the message that we heard at the doors reflected that. I mean, again, we heard again, I like you, Rick. I like whoever. But I can't stand your party. I can't stand your leader. And it's time to go, basically, is what they told us. I look at what happened to us in Southeast. We won by 300 votes against an NDP candidate that 3 months prior didn't hold an NDP membership. She barely set foot in the riding. I know she didn't knock on any doors in the riding throughout the entire campaign. She didn't live in the area. She had to ask us what communities made up her riding. And she was within 300 votes of becoming an MLA. And that should be concerning to a lot of residents in Calgary Southeast, that, again, a protest vote almost got them potentially a poor MLA. Now, time would tell what she would be able to do to represent her people, but there's no basic foundation of understanding on what the issues are in that particular constituency. Again, it's just reflective of the level of frustration with the PC party, top down. You know, there's some NDP MLAs that were elected in this campaign that are very junior, that didn't knock on any doors, that didn't talk to people, yet they captured a huge amount of votes in this campaign. And it kind of goes against everything that we're taught from a campaigning perspective. I mean, from a campaigning perspective, we're typically told that the way to win a campaign hasn't changed in the last 100 years. It's about getting on the doors, talking to people, and identifying your supporters, essentially, when you're out there. And if you look at this campaign, clearly that was not the case for a number of these these NDP, now MLAs. They didn't identify a lot of votes because they simply weren't out there on the doors to do it.
Which is kind of strange to me when you think about it, because they would have needed to in some way, shape, or form. But it worked, I guess. So the other thing that happened this week is, unfortunately, one of the MLAs that we've got to know very well over social media, unfortunately for her. Are we overreacting to what happened with Deborah Drever?
I think we're absolutely overreacting. I think we live in this social media age now where everything that you say or do in the history of your life on social media, you will wear forever. You know, we had a situation in Calgary Southeast. Our opponent was supposed to be Bill Jarvis in Calgary Southeast, and it ended up being somebody else.
Right.
Because Bill had a very brief lapse in judgment where he said something very inappropriate and was asked to step down as the candidate there. Bill's a really nice guy. Every encounter I've had with Bill has been a really positive one. I know Bill isn't a bad guy, and he didn't mean anything nefarious by what he had to say, but unfortunately in his public career, he will wear that for the rest of his life, more than likely. We look at this example of this new MLA in Calgary, Bo, as well. There's pictures taken from a number of years back of her giving the middle finger to a Canada flag, or her in front of a marijuana t-shirt or whatever. I think everyone needs to relax. I think a lot of us have had a picture taken of us in a potentially compromising situation that was taken out of context. And that's the big thing with social media. It's impossible to show context on a lot of this kind of stuff. So, you know, let's take some time, see how she pans out as an MLA. If within 2 years or so we find out that she's completely incompetent as an MLA, she's going to feel the pressure and feel the heat. And then in 4 years' time, in 2019, she'll get voted out. That's the way that the system is essentially supposed to work. So, you know, again, I think people are blowing it out of proportion to a degree. I mean, I saw something very amusing on Facebook. I'm sure you saw it as well. And it was a picture of Ralph Klein giving the middle finger to somebody. And it was prior to his public life, essentially. I think it was when he was a reporter. I remember what he was doing at the time. And it said, again, if we had the same feedback for Ralph back then, he never would have went on to be premier of this province.
Right. So. Is the youth in politics, younger people in politics, is this a good thing? It feels like a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's a really good thing. I mean, I do have some questions. Is a 20-year-old that lives at home the most qualified person to be an MLA? I wonder that.
Right.
But the fact that we can walk down the streets and still feel people buzzing about the election, and so many people got engaged on social media. I mean, the AB Vote feed was hysterical for much of the campaign.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of engagement there. And I think the NDP have attracted that younger demographic that previously didn't have a lot of involvement in politics. And I think it's a very positive thing. A big thing for me from a PC perspective, I think if the PCs are going to take the next step and reinvent themselves yet again and be relevant in this province again, I think it's going to lie heavily on the young people in that party to take a leadership position moving forward. The PC youth have been a very strong political force for the party for a number of years. And I think a lot of those people are coming of age now, and they're going to start taking positions within the senior leadership of the party. I mean, right now, the president of the PC party is very young. I mean, she's under 30 for sure. And I think the future of the PC party is bright because of how many young people we've had engaged for a number of years as well. And drawing back to the Wild Rose a little bit, I just don't see that same level of youth engagement with the party like the Wild Rose as I do the PCs and the NDPs for sure. So.
Okay. Two more. The social media aspect of this, I kind of got the impression that it was the cool kids were sitting over on this end of the table, and if you were a PC, you were just banished to the corner. How did you see it?
In the early stages of the campaign, I'd taken a bit of a managerial role on one of the campaigns, and I unfortunately, due to some personal issues, I had to step away for a little while. But we got dozens of emails on a daily basis from the central campaign essentially saying, here's the social media message of the day, or here's the premier's tweet. Everyone has to go on and retweet that. So social media got very robotic. And I think we lost our individuals from a campaign perspective. It became so centralized, and the message essentially was, we've got a select few people that are going to be the social media voices for the campaign. The rest of you don't screw it up. So essentially, you had a lot of people that spent their time just retweeting things, basically, or just regurgitating central campaign messages. So I never found really any of the PC messaging through the social media end of things to be overly compelling throughout the entire campaign. It was kind of bland and kind of generic. Now, you obviously saw that divide where you had the PC uncool kids on one side and then everybody else on the other side. And I think because from a social media standpoint, social media wanted the PCs to lose in so many ways. I mean, if you took a poll out of people that were actively engaged on social media, it would have been overwhelming how many were gunning for a PC defeat. I mean, you had some of the most vocal people on social media that you know, had very few positive things to say about any PC candidate at all. So I think social media can't win you a campaign. It doesn't translate into votes. I do think that you can lose a campaign on social media, and I think you're penalized for not being a part of the conversation. But it was interesting to see how it played out. But it's such a difficult thing to quantify. I mean, you can't look at social media activity and find out what it turns into votes, and that's the hardest thing.
But then in terms of the conversation, I felt it was kind of fascinating.
The conversation was fascinating throughout the campaign, and the fact that, you know, again, you had the premier that generated a couple of hashtags of his own kind of unknowingly throughout the campaign was amusing. And all this stuff happens in real time, which is so fascinating, too. I mean, you know, within 20 minutes of Jim Prentice saying math is hard, math is hard is trending in Alberta.
Right.
So it's really fascinating.
Yeah. Give us your impression of Rachel Notley.
Again, I've never met Rachel Notley. We follow each other on Twitter. I mean, I put it as a bit of a badge of honor for myself when she followed me on Twitter a number of months ago. But we've never had any interaction one-on-one. What I've seen from her is that she's very balanced. I don't think that she's going to wage war on the oil and gas companies like a lot of people have worried in the early stages of what this NDP government might look like. I think that she's going to do everything in her power to build partnerships instead of burning bridges. I think if she does do something like increase the corporate tax rate or initiate a royalty review or anything like that, she's going to do it in consultation with industry leaders. She's going to sit across the table from them and say, this is what we're looking at doing. Please explain to me what the ramifications of that might be. I think she's very intelligent. I think she's very charismatic as well. I think that she will represent Albertans very, very well, just from her demeanor and what she brings to the table. So we'll see what her vision is. I mean, I'm really interested in seeing her develop that vision and then implement it and take those next steps. We're seeing a lot of fear-mongering right now against Notley and the NDPs at this stage about how, you know, time to make for the Saskatchewan border because Alberta's doomed, all that kind of stuff. People need to put back into perspective that no party runs with a platform that they want to destroy a province.
Right.
Each party has a different vision of how they can make Alberta a better place. The Liberals had a platform, the NDP had a platform, the Wild Rose had a platform, the PCs, everyone had a platform. And they all just have different visions in terms of how they can make the province a better place. So, you know, I'm open-minded enough that I'm going to take a step back for a little while here for the next, maybe the next calendar year.
Yeah.
See how this NDP vision starts to crack out. And then if they're failing, if they're not doing what Albertans want them to do, then the commentary can continue. And then we can talk about what happens in 4 years' time when we go back to the polls again.
Okay. if you were to have one question that you would, if Rachel Notley was right here, was sitting with us in this room, what would be a question you would want to ask her?
I'm desperate to know who the Speaker of the House is going to be. I think that that's going to be really interesting. And I've heard rumors that David Swan is potentially someone that might become Speaker of the House. That would cripple the Liberals, unfortunately. He's the only elected member that they have. And if you're Speaker, you have to be unpartisan, unfortunately or unfortunately. Right. So that would be an interesting move if she decided to do that. Maybe Brian Mason, but then again, I think that you want him to be in cabinet, senior though. Position. So
yeah.
That decision is going to be interesting. But I think the one question that Albertans are dying to know from Rachel Notley right now is who is going to be in your cabinet. There's this idea that there is a huge drop off in talent after some of those pre-existing MLAs, someone like Joe Cece in Calgary, Rachel Notley herself. What is that cabinet going to look like? I mean, are we going to have a university student as the Minister of Education? I mean, those are questions that we're going to have answered here in the next couple of months here, and I think Albertans are dying to know.
It will sure be interesting. I still am somewhat shocked that this is going on, but I think I'm calm. Yeah, it's.
I think, again, Albertans have worn the label of being the rednecks of the West for so long, and I think what this election proved is that this particular NDP party is not as far left as people have pegged them to be, and that Albertans aren't as far right as they're pegged to be by the rest of the province. I think that we're meeting somewhere comfortably in the middle.
Yeah, I think so too. I think there's a bit of a change, but who knows? I think that I feel like in some ways people are cautiously optimistic for Rachel Notley, but this is entirely new territory. So, I mean, I think that for a lot of people, hell would have froze over before we would have voted an NDP government.
And I think that we're talking about strategic voting a little bit as well. I think a lot of people were voting for an NDP minority or voting for a PC minority, and that's why a lot of them gravitated towards the NDP. So I think the fact that you had so many people that tried to do the exact same thing, we ended up with this NDP majority all of a sudden now. So we'll see what happens. Again, I think that you might have some buyer's remorse from a few people that voted NDP just to get the PCs out of there and didn't anticipate that 45% of the rest of the province was going to do the same thing.
Right.
So, yeah.
How do we follow you on Twitter?
You can follow me on Twitter at Mr_Pinkster. That's Mr_Pinkster.
So. Cool. And you can follow me at KEVOLE. Or at ARD the podcast. You can add me as a friend on Facebook, Kevin Olenek, or you can like the page Agree or Disagree the podcast as well. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, it was fun, Kevin.
Stay tuned. We are just finalizing something, but we are going to, our next, not that you're not a major guest, by the way, but we have a pretty huge guest coming up next. I'm just finalizing that, but keep an eye out for it. All right.
Big shoes to fill, Kevin.
Big shoes to fill. Yes. All right. Thanks all. We'll talk to you all soon. Bye-bye.